Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome to the final episode of this season of the Media Roundtable. We are here to mobilize marketers to promote truth and civility in the media. And this is our season finale. This is the second part of our In Case You Missed It Best of Media Roundtable extravaganza. Last week, we went through the first 10 episodes of the series, learned a lot, hopefully gave you a nice Cliff Notes version of what we've been up to. This time, we're going to do the final 10 episodes. And there's some fascinating stuff here. If you work in the media or marketing business, we've got some of the world-class experts, people at the top of organizations like the 4As, the IAB, GARM. If you're just generally interested in the topic of media and polarization and how we can do right in this country, how we can do well by our neighbors and turn the volume down, de-escalate a little bit. We're going to talk to people like T-Pain, people like Ben Smith at the New York Times. We're going to talk to Bill O'Reilly. So wherever you sit, whatever you think, set aside all your preconceived notions and try to listen to some perspectives. Why are we doing this? We're doing this because, number one, you're busy and you probably didn't have time to listen to every single episode. So we're going to try and give you a little sample platter. But the reason we're doing the whole thing is we got a real trust crisis in this country, and it could cost us the whole thing. You know, the smarter people that we've talked to in this process, you know, you kind of ask them, what's the over under on the United States keeping it going? You know, are we going to get better or are we going to fall apart? A lot of people think it's going to fall apart, but I think the smarter, wiser people that we've talked to are kind of like, you know, I'm optimistic, but I'm not banking on it, that we're going to be able to keep doing this whole American experiment, this idea, the pursuit of these ideals. I think we all know we haven't achieved our ideals. We got a ton of problems, and we've always had a ton of problems. Some of them are getting better. Some of them aren't. They're getting worse. But for this thing to continue, we can't take it for granted. And what we have a real crisis of is trust and faith in each other. We don't give each other the benefit of the doubt. And we have a marketing machine so that we're all getting double-digit hours every day of media pumped into our brains, into our ears, into our eyes, into our minds. And a lot of the message that we are paying to receive or paying with our time to receive tells you there's bad guys and they're out to get you. And if you're wearing a red jersey, it's the ones with the blue jersey. And if you got a blue jersey, it's the one with the red jersey. And they want to destroy everything you hold dear. And we're pumping this information into ourselves and it's poisoning us. And then people like myself who work in advertising, we traffic in this stuff. You know why? Because if it bleeds, it leads. Because outrage gets attention. Outrage sells. We live in an attention economy. And so what we're trying to do with the Media Roundtable is we're trying to walk that back. We're trying to say, okay, we get it. You can get a lot of attention when you exploit people's differences. But can we actually move the carrot a little bit? Can we shift the incentive structure? We got a lot of corporations that are starting to say they want to be helpful in society. We want to be accountable for things. Well, let's pay attention to the fact that it is corporations that are either owning media or supporting it through their advertising dollars, and that we want to be better stewards of what we're sponsoring so that creators will be better stewards of what they create and consumers will consume better content that isn't just getting us all jacked up on anger all the time and destroying the foundation that we all need to live on top of to do these great inspirational things that we all want to do. So that's why we're doing this. A couple of pieces of news have come out recently that I just want to get into. And then, look, we're going to play some clips. I'm going to give you a jet tour of the second half of the season. I think you're going to learn from it. I think you're going to like it. What I want to tell you about is first article. And by the way, we're linking to these in the show description, so make sure you check it out. I have told you that this is not just a podcast. We're not just here to entertain you. And we're not even just here to inform you. We're here to actually move – and drive action. This is media in motion is what we're trying to do here. And one of the things that we got done a couple of weeks ago is we got a profile, or not a profile, I'm sorry. It was a column published in USA Today. I wrote it with the help of a lot of people that are working on this effort with me. And the title is How the Outrage Industrial Complex Profits from Stoking Americans' Anger at Each Other. Came out on June 14th of 2021. USA Today, far as I can tell, biggest publication in America. So this is resonating and we're getting the message out. You are part of something that is critical for society. And we're really starting to get traction with this message. People are starting to understand it. So we give a lot of practical advice in that article. I hope you have time to check that out. Second thing I want to tell you about is new article came out, and we can thank the folks at Ground News for opening this up. There's a real lack of trust in this country in media. In fact, Reuters Institute did a report that found that the U.S. ranks last among 46 countries in trust in media. This is a matter of trust. And how do we trust each other when we don't even trust the sources that are giving us information? That's the foundation for everything we think and believe. And then the last article that we're going to link to is that basically that the ratings are in the trash, effectively. No surprises. We all knew this was going to happen. But when Trump came into office, we started to we saw the Trump bump. Everybody talked about the Trump bump. Well, the Trump bump was a real thing. And now we are in Trump slump because, as we know, people love a fight. The media loves a fight. And guess what? We love to watch a fight. We love to gawk at this stuff. And so the Axios article that talks about this is boring news cycle deals blow to partisan media. And it just goes through some of the declines. Far left media down 27.3%. Far right media down 43.8%. Mainstream media, things like USA Today, which are more in the center, down 18.3% on average. So no surprises here. We're trafficking in outrage. We are exploiting our differences, regardless what the long-term consequences are. And we are here at the Media Roundtable trying to do something about that. We want to do something about it, and we want you to participate. So please listen today. Check out the clips. Hopefully you'll hear something you like. You'll go in and listen to some episodes that you haven't had a chance to listen to yet. But most importantly, we want you to get involved with us. And, you know, it starts with just show us that you're here with the show. If you like it, give us a rating, leave a review, wherever you're streaming this from. But more importantly, go to MediaRoundtable.com, sign up, get in the queue so we can inform you on our moves and on the difference we're trying to make. You know, at our agency, Oxford Road, we are redirecting millions of dollars away from the most polarizing content to more reliable, less biased news and opinions. Because it's everything. It's everything. So anyway, let's go through the episode. I mentioned this last week. I'll tell you again. We're going to take a break. We're going to take a couple months off. We're going to regroup. We're going to come back late August, early September with a new series. I know that a lot of what we're going to be doing is going to be very similar to what we've done before. But hey, listen, the cement is wet right now. If you got a big idea for how we can do this better, more to your liking, I want to hear from you. We want to know. We want to improve. We're trying to grow all the time. You know, feedback is the breakfast of champions. So give us your feedback. Go to MediaRoundtable.com. Tell us what you think. And with that, let's start listening to some of the highlights from a wonderful season. Here we go. Okay, so we're about to get into going through the episodes. And one thing I just noticed going through this, which is kind of funny, is that depending on where you're listening, episode 13 is strangely absent. That was our April Fool's issue. You can actually hear it on Spotify, but they took it down from iTunes. And what we did was we said, hey, look, we're going to play the world's first brand safe podcast, 100% brand safe. And because we released it on April Fool's, we basically had like 45 minutes of silence. Now, you don't need to listen to that. But the point we were trying to illustrate is that if you're in the media business, if you're sponsoring media, if you're creating media, there's nothing you can do that's going to be 100% brand safe. We need to be reasonable about this. But how can you make a more positive impact? That's really the question we're trying to deal with. And so the first episode that we're going to play you a mashup of clips from. It's going to go fast, but I want you to listen carefully because this episode was very, very important. We spoke with episode title is How the World's Leading Brands and Agencies Are Taking on Brand Safety. And we sat down with Marla Kaplowitz and Rob Rakowitz. Marla is the head of the 4A's. That's the big trade organization for all ad agencies. So basically 85-ish% of the ad dollars in the United States run through 4A's agency. Our agency, Oxford Road, is a 4A's agency. We also had Rob Rakowitz, who is the initiative lead for GARM. That is Global Advertisers for Responsible Media. That's the big initiative for the World Federation of Advertisers. So this is like 90% of the marketing dollars in the world run through GARM companies. They are touching everybody, everything. And so they are knee deep in this problem. And, you know, as they explain it, privacy is a top concern and brand safety is a top concern. And we're all just trying to figure out how do you work this out in real life. So I'm going to play you a couple of clips. You'll know which one's Robin, which one's Marla. And you're going to hear them talk about things like the influence of content monetization. So how do brands and marketers actually play a constructive role in this process in terms of dictating what type of media is worth creating? They're going to talk about brand safety. They're going to talk about how to deal with misinformation and the expectations that have really shifted with corporations. Because one thing brands are dealing with suddenly is that they are expected to do well by doing good. They are expected to advance not just the needs of the shareholders, but also the stakeholders. And in the process of doing that, they can't just do what's called virtue signaling, which is, you know, post something fancy on Instagram and say, you know, we stand in solidarity with so-and-so. They're like, okay, what are you going to do about it? And how are you going to make that measurable? And that's where the world is going. It's a big shift. And so from two veterans at the center of all of this, Marla and Rob, they're going to break that down for us. So let's take a listen.
When someone who's working in an agency environment opens their laptop or looks at their phone in the morning to the end of the day, what are the types of problems that are coming up that you're setting out to address? Like, what does that really look like?
Oh, gosh, there are so many different problems that they're trying to address. If we focus in on the brand safety and suitability piece.
Yeah, on the brand safety and suitability.
Yeah, but even within brand safety and suitability, yeah, there are so many different aspects. So that the last thing that you want to see is that your brand ended up adjacent to content that you did not approve and that is inappropriate for your brand. So the most extreme is you are an airline and you get put opposite in a video that's showing an airplane crash, for example. So sure, that's one. Something that happens in the news that you weren't able to address ahead of time and change your controls on. And I think this is a really good point to talk about because what ends up happening is you have inclusion and exclusion lists and many marketers end up going to the extreme on exclusion lists so that they don't have to worry about trying to manage any sort of risk, right? So they're trying to mitigate that. The problem is you narrow your inventory and you're narrowing your reach and you're hurting publishers and journalists as a result of that.
Content monetization, on the other hand, is really where agencies as well as brands have a right to play and win and sort of set a bit of a standard. And this is really where we've been coming into, which is, look, we cannot rightly solve content moderation, but we do have a right to talk about monetization. And ultimately, the two of these topics are two sides of the same coin, in essence, which is how do we make sure that media platforms are a force for good and that the light side of it always outshines the shadow side of it.
So my question for you is, what do you think the minimum expectation is, but when do people need to get back to focusing on their scope?
Well, when you say getting back to their scope, I think it gets back to the scope has expanded and every brand interprets that scope differently. And we saw this last year in particular, first with the pandemic, you know, what were brands going to be saying? did they have a strong purpose to begin with? Because you very quickly saw those that didn't come from a strong foundation trying to say, you know, we're all in this together. And really, what are the actions that you're taking to demonstrate that? And then, of course, with everything that happened around George Floyd and the actions that brands were taking, there was a lot that were putting a lot of words out there, but weren't following up with actions. People are really looking to make sure that there's follow up behind that. But we know from the trust barometer survey that Edelman puts out that every year that more and more people are looking to businesses to have a voice, to guide the way, because the media and governments and NGOs have been failing in that area.
Things like media investment will come under scrutiny, and making sure that there is an understanding of where things go, making sure that there is a link between beliefs as well as behaviors. So I do think that this is what used to be an engine room issue, meaning that it was highly technical, is now a boardroom issue. And I think that's a major shift that we've seen over the last, let's just say, 16 months. Because when I first walked into this challenge in 2010, and then it became much more serious in 2017, it's now raised to a level that it's never been before. And I think that this is here to stay.
There's a fair amount where it's easier to say, let's just avoid it altogether rather than try and understand it in terms of what is opinion journalism? What is quality? How do you define quality? What does that look like? What's objective these days? What is truth and veracity within that? And that's one of the bigger issues. And that's why we're so focused on misinformation and disinformation right now and trying to break that down. But I do know that agencies are working very hard to try and educate marketers on the need to be in news and also how to understand it and who you should work with. So you look at IPG working with NewsGuard, for example. Mm-hmm. There are providers out there that are really trying to help wade through the complexity of what is out there so they can make more discerning choices. But we know from the trust barometer survey that Edelman puts out that every year that more and more people are looking to businesses to have a voice, to guide the way, because the media and governments and NGOs have been failing in that area. So there is a responsibility, but it also requires risk. Back to the risk again, because you have to put yourself out there. And is it a CEO doing it? Is it a brand doing it? And we know that we've moved beyond focusing in on shareholders. It is about stakeholders. It's about your employee base. It's about your customer base. It's not just about the people that own your stock. And that is critical to make sure that you think about that. And depending upon the brand, you really have to make sure that you are putting a voice out there that does adhere to your core brand values and purpose. And if you do that, it will be authentic and the risk should be lower. But we live in a world that's very polarized. And so there are always going to be people that agree and those that disagree. And you have to decide as a brand what you believe in long term and how you want to take actions.
Okay, so we're going to skip playing any clips from the next episode, but let me just give you a quick recap of what it actually is. We talked to two Emmy Award winning journalists about how do you talk about news without the venom? And so we had on Jill Wagner and Carlo Versano. They both work full time for Cheddar News. Jill's the one of the key anchors there in the morning. And they have a podcast called Need to Know. And so it's an interesting conversation. We put it out on April 21st. And the big thing on this one is that, like, you know, we talk about all these values. And the challenge anytime you're talking about a value is like, all right, how does this work in real life? Well, what they're doing on Need to Know is they're actually living out the values. They are actually taking different perspectives, having civil discourse in an entertaining, interesting way that is giving people news that they don't have to, you know, pick a side all the time. They can just hear journalists trying to do what journalists historically have been tasked with doing. And so, interesting one, if you have time to give that one a listen. Now, April 28th, this one's a big deal, particularly if you work in the business. you know, this is arguably one of the smartest or one of the smartest people in the business. This is Brad Behrens, who is a friend of mine. We actually are both advisors to Adfontes Media, the makers of the Media Bias Chart, which we talk about all the time. So Brad joined us as the editor-in-chief of the IAB. IAB, for the uninitiated, is the Interactive Advertising Bureau. And basically, their membership accounts for about 86% of all online advertising, including podcasts. So great industry conversation. And, you know, we had kind of the triumvirate of top industry trade group experts between GARM through the WFA and the 4As and now IAB. And Brad's got incredible perspectives. I'm going to play you a mashup of a few of these clips that we have. But here's what he talks about. You know, he talks about kind of picking up on what we played last time, brands taking a stand. This is a really new thing. And one of the things he starts to share is that, you know, you can be values driven in what advertising decisions that you make without being polarized. So he explains that. And then he talks about, you know, the failings of some of the current solutions that are out there for marketers and the importance of news. It is so, so, so important that we do not abandon the fourth estate in this country and that we support good journalism. And one thing that the IAB did, and again, if you're in the industry, it's worth you looking this up. They came out with a report called the News Trust Halo, which he's going to talk about a little bit, but I'll give away part of the punchline here, is that what they figured out is people may have real credibility problems with the news. However, the advertisers that are adjacent to it generally come out with more credibility than if they were to advertise somewhere else. It is usually neutral or positive, far, far and away more than there is a negative affiliation that comes off. And the reason this is important is because so many advertisers are fleeing the genre. So many people don't want to touch news, don't want to touch opinion, which is critical for our democracy, as well as keeping an informed populace. So he's going to talk about that. Let's listen to Brad.
It's harder and harder for brands to not take a stand. And yet frequently marketing departments are uneasy taking those stands. We're also seeing that particularly with the younger D2C direct brands. So Tom's Shoes, for example, is a great example, a very values driven brand. For every pair of the shoes that you buy, they give a pair of shoes to someone who ordinarily or otherwise wouldn't be able to afford shoes. So that question of how do we get a deeper investment from our customers whose values align with ours, and what is the sacrifice that we're making if we're possibly not appealing to as broad a population as possible? I think that is a dilemma. And I would say, our brand disruption research at the IAB is beginning to investigate this. These are questions that I have rather than answers I can provide. Now, values don't necessarily have to be around polarizing issues. There are lots of things that people can talk about and look for something that is not really common in our political discourse right now, which is, you know, what are the things that we agree on? And so, you know, whether or not you believe in climate change, you probably want, you know, less litter, right? I mean, so there are things that you can do. Values does not have to mean that you're going towards something that is going to, is going to alienate a large portion of the population. It just so happens that so many of those issues are very salient right now because we've been coming off of 4 years of intense polarization, and now we are still dealing with a largely divided government. You've got keyword blocking, which is very dangerous because it frequently doesn't understand sentiment. So there were companies that were blocking news reporting of COVID, for example, because they were worried about being associated with something negative. But what if it was a story about someone who miraculously recovered from COVID and was doing great? So an absence of sentiment analysis can sometimes be the undoing of keyword blocking. There's also exclusion lists, and you know much more about this than I do. And Google just last week has announced that they have some kind of dynamic exclusion lists. Exclusion lists are unfortunately at the kind of domain level, right? We don't want anything from the New York Times or we don't want anything from, some other source. So we don't have a sufficiently pointy tool yet that can in real time analyze content and figure out is this something that is good or bad for us? The NewsTrust Halo, we did a consumer survey. We did it with Magid. And what we found in general was that the old myth that brands are going to suffer if they advertise within hard or breaking news was just that, a myth. The kind of cliched version is that no airline wants to advertise next to a story about a plane crash because they're worried about the association. Sure. What we found is that that's just not true. And by the way, just to say, far worse than your kind of end of day scenario with keyword blocking and exclusion lists is people who just say no news at all. Like, we're not going to advertise in the news at all.
Massive problem. Massive problem. So many brands are doing that.
Those kinds of standards of objectivity in some ways occurred because journalism was becoming increasingly professionalized, but also because it was what was best for business, right? If the largest audience would come to you because they believed that they were going to get the straight story, well, that straight story was going to be relatively narrow. And there was a profound downside to this because it tended to be that the people who were making news, the people who were the focus of the news, were not a population that we would consider diverse or equitable today or inclusive. So it was a narrow subsection of the people who were in power, but it was at least, you know, a relatively consistent and attempt at objectivity. That was a far cry from, if you look at sort of the, you know, the era of yellow journalism with William Randolph Hearst, where they were profoundly incendiary, attempting to create kind of outrage and passion because it sold papers. The same thing that's true of journalism today, and particularly when it comes to algorithmically driven things, is that the more passion it evokes, the more likely it is to spread. And so, although virality, I think, is largely a myth, where we've gotten to is the pendulum swung from incendiary at the beginnings of 20th century journalism through a kind of quiet period of, like I said, more centralized, narrower, but perhaps objective journalism, you know, the era of Walter Cronkite. And now, with the extraordinary fragmentation of media, of centralization of newspapers, because we have so few of them, but, you know, general, you know, media in general just exploding, we're getting back to a highly polarized kind of media. I think that there is some responsibility on the part of the news consumer. And the good news, as I said earlier, is that the average American news consumer is consulting four different news sources a day. If you only get your news from one source, then you're not, as an individual, then you're not kind of trying to disconfirm anything. I subscribe to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the Oregonian. I live in Oregon. I also get The Economist, watch television news, listen to podcasts. So I'm kind of like Pac-Man chewing my way through a bunch of information. And there's a profound difference between the coverage that the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and the New York Times will train on any individual issue. So media literacy is not something that is currently taught in schools very well. It's not something that we necessarily talk about enough as a culture. It's important for journalists, I think, to be aware of this lack. And that's part of the reason why for brands, you know, the NewsTrust Halo study is about journalism by large journalistic organizations, right?
All right. You've all been very patient, well-behaved as we get into the inner workings of the media industry and how that all shakes out. But let's have some fun with this next one. It is T-Pain, singer turned rapper turned singer. He's got two Grammys. He's worked with everyone from Lil Wayne to Taylor Swift. And he's a mogul. I mean, he's got Nappy Boy Entertainment with all these different lines of business. And this guy has made a gazillion dollars, lost it all, come back again. And he gives really good advice. He's also launching a podcast, which is the reason that we got in touch with him. But I'll tell you why. Well, I'm only going to play a couple short clips, but let me just try to encourage you that if you're going to pick one episode, really try to listen to T-Pain, because this guy takes an approach to the subject matter that is different than everybody else, but very, very practical, very, very useful. I mean, you have to think, if you're going to sell millions of records, if you're going to promote yourself, you are a brand, you have to steward a brand. He talks with us a little bit about when he has been canceled, as he sees it and how he's dealt with that. But most importantly, I think that this is the only person that we've talked to. And, you know, we've been for the last couple of years, we've done, you know, probably 40 to 50 episodes. This is the first person that's really come on and said very succinctly in a very entertaining way what this whole thing comes down to. And a lot of it just comes down to just getting over yourself and being able to rise above people that are trying to take you down because you're different than they are. And if you can actually not get pulled down into the mud with them, and if you can actually be loving towards somebody who is different than you, even if they're attacking you, boy, what an effective winning strategy that is. And so he's going to talk about that a little bit here, but please, please, please go listen to this one. The guy is amazingly profound. And this episode is titled T-Pain Takes a Seat at the Media Roundtable and Buys Us a Drink. That came out on May 5th. Here's T-Pain.
I've been canceled probably six times by now.
Okay.
I think it's six. It may have been
okay.
Seven.
Okay.
You have a largely unpopular opinion. Everybody has their right to an opinion. And if you have one that's different from the majority or that's making you look like, you know, hey, guys, look at me. I'm a good person. Because that's essentially what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you have that unpopular opinion, it's the internet's job to let you know how good of a person every single person is. I would say embrace everybody. You know,
even
the people that hate you, you know, bring them in for a f-ing hug. You know, anytime somebody comes on spewing hate, you know, even on my Twitch channel, when it's like live and I'm reading the chat and then somebody's just spewing some f-ing hateful shit, I'm like, dude, I don't know what you're going through, man, but if you need to talk, let's do it. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's lay it out. You want to come on the stream? We'll get on Discord. We'll just talk it out.
All right. So this next episode is a little bit broader in nature. It's really for anybody who's interested in the idea of polarization and how we come together as a country. The title of the episode is Using Conflict to Bring Peace, How One Marketer Leans Into Conflicts to Bring People Closer. And the guest is Kieran O'Connor. He's Chief Marketing Officer at Braver Angels. Now, just so you know, there's a few different organizations that are really committed to this working across differences idea. One is the National Institute for Civil Discourse, who is a partner with us, a founding partner of the Media Roundtable. But the other one is Braver Angels, was going to be Better Angels. And then I think they got into a little bit of a scuffle, ironically, with Ken Burns, who's like the documentarian extraordinaire in this country telling our history. Well, his production company was Better Angels, and so they couldn't both be Better Angels. So anyway, these guys are Braver Angels, but they have a huge organization, and what they do is they sit down people from both sides through media content, workshops, skills training, and they get into these huge debates in local communities where they take hot button issues and they're like, okay, we're going to facilitate a conversation that doesn't end in a brawl, food fight, you know, basically everything you see when you turn on cable news. So Kieran's going to talk to us about this. And just a quick sneak peek, you know, some of the things that are interesting is like, you know, number one, what's happening and why did he, as somebody who's like, I mean, this guy was a speechwriter for Obama, for Hillary Clinton, and he left all that great career. And then he ended up going into running Braver Angels and marketing peace and going from supporting political candidates on one side of the aisle. And he said, this is crazy. How do we do something better here? So he's going to talk about why he made that decision, the importance of trust. And the really interesting piece is he actually is going to give us some practical guidance on how to approach a political conversation with someone that you disagree with, because I don't think any of us have the training. Like, we're all in these wars. I think we all need a bit of marriage counseling in this country to even know how to communicate with each other without it devolving into total chaos. And the last thing is he talks about, like, how do you market peace when we all know that the incentive structure, the way to get attention is to pick a fight. So when your job is to facilitate peacemaking, how do you get people's attention without playing to that formula? And so he's going to talk about that. Really cool episode. Strongly recommend that you listen. And here's a little sample.
After the 2016 election, I was considering jumping back on another Democratic campaign, but I was really increasingly troubled by the deeper divides in our country. Things had gotten to the point where people no longer viewed their political opponents as simply wrong or misguided or misinformed. but increasingly viewed them as bad people, contemptuous people, people who were utterly worthless, people who were a threat to all of our values. And that's not to say that politics is or should be about being nice or being civil or being polite. There's a reason there's a lot of war metaphors in politics. It's a competitive sport. We have deep disagreements in this country. That's the way it's supposed to be. But we're no longer playing on the field. We're basically trying to blow up each other's tour buses before we even take the field, I think is an apt metaphor. So I was really troubled by that. And I wanted to find a way to work on this underlying problem, this problem that was fueling so much gridlock, so much heart sickness in the country. And so I got involved with then named Better Angels right at the beginning to help tell the story of the organization and to help give Americans an opportunity to talk across enemy lines, to build relationships, and to develop a model for our politics and our political culture that can hopefully change norms and incentivize behavior both within communities and within the political class that can make for a healthier political culture and a revitalized social fabric, and one that can help us make progress on the enormous challenges that are facing America. So We have essentially in this country tens of millions of Americans who are accusing their fellow Americans of purposefully trying to undermine democracy and their rights. And that's a dangerous thing. And I think we could continue to see violence unless we're really able to make progress on this deeper issue of social trust and trust in each other and institutions. Because when you don't trust sources of information, you don't trust institutions, and you don't trust your neighbor, that's when you are vulnerable to believing in conspiracy theories. And that's where you find meaning and identity in dangerous tribalism. I think the biggest, most important rule, if you are approaching a political conversation with someone you disagree with, if you want it to be a productive conversation, is to abandon the expectation that you're going to change their mind, because you're not. And We always just are conditioned to go into political conversations that we need to defend our position. We need to find a way to make the other person look stupid or ignorant or cruel. And we're not really listening to what they have to say. We're waiting to make our point. We're waiting to paint them into a corner. We're waiting to ascribe the worst characteristics of the politician they support to them and anyone like them. And we are looking to exaggerate and caricature the disagreements we have so that we're on the side of the righteous and they're on the side of the evil, essentially. And so we help develop tips and principles for having those conversations that make them productive. And, you know, it's not for everyone, right? I mean, again, this is sort of a coalition of the willing, but there is an appetite here for what we're doing because people recognize that the current environment is unhealthy. We need to clarify what the disagreements actually are, because people have become addicted to the sort of conflictual framing of everything, us versus them, because it's part of their identity, right? Your identity is that you are progressive, and that identity is formed in opposition to another tribe. And people feel like even engaging with the other tribe in any other manner than a pure zero-sum dominate or submit dynamic will somehow undermine their own identity. And, you know, they're fraternizing with the enemy. How could you even talk to that person, right? And that sort of attitude is very dangerous and also counterproductive, because it leads to groupthink. It leads to orthodoxy. It stifles creativity. And again, it destroys the relationships that make up the fabric of the country and upon which the democratic experiment is built.
You are marketing a really interesting product. What do you do in your role to market Braver
Angels? Well, I think a lot of the powerful part of marketing Braver Angels is storytelling, right? I mean, That's how we make meaning. That's how we find community. And that's how we form identity. is through stories and through seeing ourselves in other people and seeing that fellow humanity. And part of the problem with the political polarization is it's turned our fellow Americans into enemies. And so what we seek to do at Braver Angels is to try to tell the story, the rich tapestry of Americans who are different from one of us, but with whom we can see common values, and to lift up the relationships that have transcended political division, because that then spreads a more inspiring and hopeful narrative that can sort of trigger the human need for love, just the way the fear messaging can trigger the fight or flight, right? I mean, that's sort of a constant battle that's going on in humans.
The next episode is titled The Unwinnable Culture War, a conversation with radio host Steve Dace. Steve was our guest on May 19th. He's part of the Blaze Media Network. Steve's an interesting guy, and depending on where you sit politically, you probably love him or hate him. If you voted for Trump, you like Trump, you're probably going to like Steve. He's intense, passionate, very articulate. And I think he does a great job representing his viewpoints, whether or not you agree with him. But, you know, you might have very strong negative reactions if you listen to his program. I'm not here to pander to one side or the other. I really don't care. I think both sides are important to hear. Both sides are important to understand. And that doesn't mean we have to give everybody a platform. But in Steve's case, I think it's important that we know what he thinks and what his audience prioritizes. Some of the things that we talked about on this episode are the absence of critical thinking, which is a charge that I think you'd probably hear from people on both sides of the aisle. But, you know, we really do have a gap in this country of people not just wanting to be fed what is predictable or what's comfortable or what's not going to be, you know, intellectually painful to take. And we need to be intellectually honest. And I think that's a value that is critically important for us to make any progress here. He also talks about, you know, the culture clash, but ultimately, you know, we got to remember a lot of what we're trying to do here is about corporate America. And he has some very strong words for people that are wading into the culture war, possibly for opportunistic reasons, possibly because they just have specific values. But when that can be alienating toward one side of the country, this is a very confusing time. And so I like that he spoke candidly and gave some feedback that you might not hear in the circles that you're running in. I think it's worth a listen.
I also think that social media has made it worse, both in that we have more access to each other's fallibilities, number one, as you just pointed out. But then you would think, though, wouldn't you think that that would actually encourage us to be more sensitive to the fact we're more exposed and more available, right? And I think instead, there's almost like this shameless flaunting of, I'm actually proud of the fact that I just am completely oblivious to what I project to other people, you know? And I think that's a sign of a lack of critical thinking, that I'm not even assessing my place in the grand scheme of things. I'm not contemplating before I say and do something, how will this be thought of? How will this be considered? This is the growing challenge in my line of work, is how do I communicate truth? Because I'm not the Associated Press. Mm-hmm. I don't have stringers gathering data and facts and stories for me across the country. So, I don't even think we're polarized. We're balkanized. What I mean is,
I'm going to need you to break that down. Yeah.
Yeah, there's too many places in America where it doesn't matter if your neighbor is your kid's godparents. If they have a D after their name or an R after their name, they have no shot of getting your vote in certain places in this country. We're balkanized. We're literally different cultures, kind of like an American Yugoslavia. Different cultures all kind of living in the same landmass, trying to figure out how to live together. I warn people, do not drag corporate America into our culture war. I'm not sure you're going to like the outcome of this. So are you sure it's worth the blowback, putting your thumb on the culture war scale? Better make sure you count the cost of that, would be my advice.
I want to drill down a little bit further on the culture war piece, because my view and I think the approach that we're taking with Media Roundtable is that nobody's actually going to win the culture war, is that it's an unwinnable war.
But I am fearful that all institutions are getting pulled into it, whether they wanted to or not, and that and that everybody's kind of playing along. And I wonder what you think. Do you think it is a winnable war? Do you think that is the right approach? Is it, should everybody be fighting fire with fire? Or is there a different way that you would advocate for?
It's not a winnable war. It's an unavoidable one on the path, however, that we are on. And so how do you counter that? You create a situation where you send a message to them. This is not a winnable war. This is mutually assured destruction.
If you get a chance, the next episode, we're not going to play any clips, but it's a good listen. It's with the CEO and founder of Hint Inc., which you probably know of, Hint Water. Kara is the founder, and the episode is her journey to creating a values-driven brand. So a little bit off topic in that it isn't purely focused on media polarization, but you know, here's what one of the things I'll say about Kara is that she really has built a company that is organic in every sense of the word, you know, in every way that you can have a set of values that informs what is your product? How are you going to make your product? How are you going to distribute your product? How are you going to treat your employees? How are you going to market it? She's got a really clear vision and through line and has been doing stakeholder capitalism since before we all started talking about stakeholder capitalism. So if you get a chance, listen to Kara. Let me talk to you about what the Media Roundtable really is. It's not just a podcast, it's a movement. Negative polarization is making all of us miserable. We've talked about how 80% of Americans now believe that the country is falling apart. And meanwhile, private companies are the most trusted institutions in America, while trust in media has never been lower. And the irony here is that it's these same private companies that actually make news media possible through sponsorship. So the Media Roundtable joins together media and marketers and mobilizes them to promote truth and civility in journalism. We're committed to increasing advertiser support for content that shares our values of clarity, fairness, truth, tolerance, respect, and de-escalation. By the way, you can learn more about this when you read the pledge in full at MediaRoundtable.com. So if you're in media or marketing, you can make a powerful difference in helping to bind the wounds of our fractured nation without compromising your business goals or your brand values. Media Roundtable is here to help by providing resources and support for our members every step of the way. We want you to get involved. All you need to do is visit MediaRoundtable.com and sign the pledge right now. This next episode came out on June 2nd. It's a conversation with Ben Smith, and we called it The State of the Fourth Estate, Part 3, because I don't know if you know about Ben Smith, but he is like the journalist's journalist. I have a lot of respect for him, even if, you know, there's a lot of people that disagree with different positions he takes or things that he'll cover. He takes a lot of risks as a journalist. You know, one of the things that's interesting about him is he came over to BuzzFeed when it was all like listicles and cats videos and stuff like that. And it was a bunch of clickbait. And they basically said, we're going to turn this into a serious journalistic institution, and he built out their news organization, made it very formidable. Then he left there and he went back to being a columnist for the New York Times. So he is now the media editor for the New York Times. So, you know, what I have found in kind of going down this rabbit hole and this trail that I've been on is that if you're in the business and you're paying attention, you know Ben Smith. You are reading his column every week. You want to know what he has to say. And he's gonna take on anybody. He is not here to make friends, but he has very keen insights. And I just thought that this is like the easiest listening in the world if you're like me and fascinated by this subject. And so I'm going to play a series of clips from him. Some of the things that he's going to cover are like, you know, misconceptions about the state of media, because I do think there's a historical context that some of us miss. And he talks about, you know, what is real bias and where is it overrepresented? And then like, how does this work out in the economics of the business? You know, how does it kind of move through the chain so that decisions are made out of fear? And how can we manage these things a little bit more effectively? I mean, one of the things we're going to end on is him talking about, you know, how do we deal with platforms and
deciding who gets deplatformed and for what, and what should the future look like. But you know, he's not afraid to take positions. And I just really, really, really strongly encourage you to listen to this episode. But let's start with some clips.
One thing that a lot of media criticism sometimes relies on is an idea that there was some mythical golden age when everything was really good, American journalism was great, and that is not true. And American journalism has always had massive problems. It just has somewhat different ones now. And also, you know, there's always been journalism that was written to kind of, that was super biased or kind of pandering to its audience. But I think social media, you know, offers a different and kind of very powerful centralizing force around some of that. So I guess that's probably what I was talking about. I mean, I do think the central like fact of American politics that spills into media is just polarization, and that almost any issue now polarizes. I think like those are cases where I think the whining about the good old days of objectivity is sort of nonsense. On the other hand, I do think that right now you can just get a cheering section on social media. I mean, the obvious case is Trump. You write something bad about Trump. You write, like, I've discovered that Trump had some shady dealings with some bad person. And just it's and maybe it turns out that what you're saying isn't really new, or that it doesn't quite say what you imply, but there's just a huge audience for that. And so I do think there's that can certainly like encourage a kind of sloppiness in that reporting. It's interesting, like, what are the signals that tells you that you should avoid something? And often, I mean, my own feeling is always that if there's a story that you feel like you read the headline and you just kind of know it's true and it like confirms everything you ever believed, that one is probably false. And you need to be like, it's almost like it's sort of your own filter that you have to be most wary of, not the way in which you're being manipulated by the platforms or by the media companies, but the extent to which they're just playing to the most sort of like basic psychological mechanisms. There are two categories of things that are then very complicated for corporate managers, right? Like, one is, right, we want you to issue a statement on something where your employees are really deeply divided. Like, let's say the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Right.
And the other is, we want you to issue a statement on something where it'll do huge damage to the business. See, there was a time when management was really, really good at saying, like, we're going to set up a committee to examine this and report back to you in 3 years, or maybe not ever. And now it's like, we must have a tweet in response immediately. And they're just constantly getting baited into these stupid fights that ruin the career often of some very junior person. And by the way, like, all the people who were tweeting about it have totally moved on and forgotten it was ever a thing. Like, you don't want to make a statement, don't make a statement. Then don't complain that you're on some list of companies, that is some accurate list of companies that didn't make a statement. Like, that's fine. Be proud that you didn't make a statement because you agree with Dan and you think corporations should keep their mouths shut on this stuff. I do think that the sort of dynamics of the ad industry, the sort of internal dynamics, an extent to which like a junior media buyer is afraid of getting in trouble with her boss because she bought something that creates some embarrassing adjacency, and her boss is afraid of getting in trouble with her boss, who's afraid that the client could find out about this, and the CMO is terrified that the CEO is going to be embarrassed. And so it like, and all in each of those decisions, you're like, you know what, I'm just going to avoid news. I'm going to like kind of inadvertently destroy the news business. I do think the notion of creating some kind of, even if it's kind of bullshit, system where that junior ad buyer can say, look, like, I checked with the thing you told me to check with and it said that this was okay. And the CMO can say to the CEO, actually, like, we outsourced this to this third party we trust. And like, this wasn't a screw up. This was the plan. And we did it in a responsible way. Because of course, this whole, like, the notion that anybody ever actually got in trouble because their ad ran against some, you know, stupid story they didn't like no one ever cared about that except in the insides of those companies. Like, the only time I've certainly had experiences,
yeah,
you know, talking to executives and buyers who were like freaked out because they had seen some adjacency that somebody took a screenshot on Twitter and tweeted it. But like, the person who took the screenshot on Twitter was joking. No one cared. And there are these sort of fear-driven internal cultural things at agencies and marketing departments that if you could find some way to circuit break those, that would be great for it.
Tell me about your general thoughts on deplatforming figures. Where should the line be?
This is where I guess I would hope that there's something that you get to kind of a place where there's a less binary solution between deleting someone's account and letting them speak, you know, live to a zillion people all at once. That's not a requirement. And I think there are sort of questions around amplification and going viral. And Twitter has at times experimented with making it impossible to retweet stuff, for instance, which is a pretty powerful tool. So somebody's followers can see it, but it's pretty hard for them to share it. I think things like that are probably better solutions to me. I do think there's something troubling about American corporations deciding who has a voice.
Okay, we're getting close to the end here, and I want to talk about our June 9th episode, Buy Local, The Case to Save Local News, from Will Phipps of Protect Our Press. Will is doing an initiative with a few other folks called Protect Our Press. Very, very compelling. He's going to explain what that is. But, you know, look, here's what's cool about it from my point of view is it's a very parallel initiative to what we're doing at the Media Roundtable, but it's kind of a bottom-up approach where they are starting with local. And, you know, we were talking earlier about the credibility gap, how nobody trusts journalists and media in the United States. Well, you know, one of the stats in that article, which we have linked in the description, is that local is excluded from that. People are actually not claiming that local is untrustworthy. And so it's really good that there's a movement because local has been dying out. It's really kind of a bummer that all of the money is going towards, you know, Jerry Springer versions of news. And instead, you know, local legitimate sources that are providing communities with very helpful information on a local or national basis, they're doing better journalism and they're not making money for doing that. So I'm glad that there's a movement behind it. Very, very compelling stuff. And the last clip that I'm going to play here is actually myself, which is kind of terrible that I'm playing a clip of myself on this podcast. But there's a concept that I want to introduce because I think we're going to talk more about it in the future. And that is the idea that, look, the fourth estate is the job of media. It's an old, old term that Will actually talks about in this episode, the origins of it. But the point is they're there to hold power to account. And so what happens when those who are tasked with holding power to account are not held to account themselves? And that's what is happening with a lot of the corporate-owned media that we're all consuming and transacting with. And, you know, one of the questions that we come up with is, who watches the Watchmen? And so the question is, are brands now the fifth estate? Is it now up to corporations to police media so that it does its job in policing the institutions of government? Because right now, corporations are the last trusted institution. So it's a, you know, heavy is the head that wears the crown, but it has to be dealt with. And they're in a very interesting position to do that because corporations, as we keep talking about, they're buttering the bread of the media. So check this one out if you can. Here's a couple sample clips for you.
Tell us about Protect Your Press.
A movement that is just, you know, is small but growing. And really it's centered around a commitment. It's a call to action, very much industry focused, asking agencies, brands, publishers, even individuals, just to rethink their relationship with professional news journalism because it's dying out. And it felt like we as media agencies particularly were so culpable in the demise because we as media agencies have too often check the box of saying no to news adjacency because clients may or may not be worried about the volatility of news and where their ads are placed. When you interpret the world only through unverified news, you know, fake news is just one of the generalisms for it, but it's really about being unverified rather than purposely false. Then you live your life assessing the world through punditry and opinion, not verified fact. And that process of a newsroom, that verification of fact, which is so central to the DNA of a professional journalist, is what you then lose. And when you lose fact, then how are you really looking at the world? An opinion is fine when you know it's opinion, but do you want the voice of one animated, maybe politically motivated blogger to let you interpret what's going on? Or would you sooner have some professionals who at least care enough to make sure that what they're saying is true? I'd love to talk to you briefly about brand safety, because I've been having this thought. The very reason that some clients have challenged news adjacency is because of brand safety.
Right.
I'd actually argue that news is one of the most brand safe places to be, because if you are there, you know, I'm up for some provocation. If you are there in a verified place, the content might be volatile and unpredictable, but it's got to be safer than somewhere like YouTube, where they've got something like 10,000 moderators, and even that isn't enough. There's brands buying on YouTube that just have no idea where they're being adjacent to.
One thing we've been talking about is that corporations are becoming the fifth estate. They're there to now hold the journalists to account
because we've got this situation where everybody's a journalist and the journalists have all gone wild. And so somebody's got to rein them in. Now, what you're seeing is corporations look at where, you know, what happened. They were starting to build some trust. And then 2008 to 2010 happens. They went in the gutter again. Nobody trusted big, bad corporations. Now, all of a sudden, they're the most trusted institution in the world. And they're going, yes, we're going to solve society's problems. We're going to address these things. And I'm like, okay, that's awesome. But if you're going to do that, how about you don't shit where you eat? Pardon my French on that. But like, if we're funding corporations and sponsoring content that is purely based on exploiting our differences and putting us at odds for each other so you can get more eyeballs, so you can sell more mattresses, that's not congruent with this stakeholder capitalism model. So as long as corporations are going to raise their hand and say, we are purpose-driven, then stop polluting society with all of this divisive content.
So here we are at the final episode. And interestingly, as we're doing a series on polarization in media, it's probably fitting that we ended with No Spin Meets the Media Roundtable, a conversation with Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly is somebody that you probably have feelings about one way or the other. Very, very polarizing for a number of reasons. Interestingly, the day before we started recording this, it was announced that he's actually going on a tour with Donald Trump, where they're going to be selling tickets to arenas around the country. And Bill is going to be playing the part of Yukon Cornelius in this and basically showing that, you know, he can ask tough questions of the former president and that the president is willing to receive those questions and explain it in a matter of fact way. We'll see how that goes. In the meantime, you know, the first thing that we talk about this episode, and I'm not going to play you clips of this part, but if you're interested, you can listen. We talked about his book. And what you got to remember about Bill O'Reilly is that he has played a major role in the evolution of how we do media in this country. I mean, this is somebody that kind of came up in the old school world of broadcast news. And then he went on to be the first really leading host on Fox News that started introducing opinion into a nightly news broadcast. That was totally foreign. That wasn't something that people did. He did that, and he did it so effectively that he led the ratings in cable news for 16 years. And then he came out and started doing a book series. It's the Killing series. So there's Killing Everybody, there's Killing Jesus, Killing Patton. Well, he just did one called Killing the Mob, which is the first thing that we talk about in the first section of the show. I have to tell you, it's a really good book. I don't care what you think about Bill O'Reilly. Between he and his writing partner, these guys did a fantastic job. And as somebody that loves history, very interesting perspective on the country as you look at the influence of the mob and connections to Hollywood, to labor, to politics, government. I mean, it is really a fascinating, fascinating story. But what was kind of interesting in our conversation is as we're talking about it, you know, we jumped to Richard Nixon and the impact that the mob had on elections in the 1960s. And what was sort of interesting is that it was Roger Ailes that really took Richard Nixon and helped redeem him from a PR standpoint, kind of taught him how to be media friendly and coached him, because we all know he lost the 60 election among a number of reasons because he was sweating profusely on camera. It was the first televised debate. Well, so there's kind of this connective tissue between these major monumental elections that are happening in the 1960s. And the guy that is very influential in 68 with Nixon getting elected actually launches Fox News and Bill O'Reilly's career. And they work together for decades. Another polarizing figure. Can't find a lot of people to say great things about Roger Ailes. Bill may be one of them. But here's what I would put forth as you think about listening to this episode. You can't argue with the success that he has had. Not only did he have the top cable news show, his Killing series is the top selling series, nonfiction book series in history. And now he's going on a tour with the former president. So this guy, Bill O'Reilly, knows how to draw a crowd. He knows how to get people's attention. He knows how to hold their attention. And look, I don't care if you love him or hate him or what you think about him. I believe we can all learn from everybody. So let's take a listen to some of the things that he has to share. I actually found him refreshingly candid on this topic. And I thought there would be more points of contention. There really weren't with the areas that we're going into, but he's going to talk about the Fox business model and how that has permeated the media ecosystem and the state of media today, including how corporations get involved. So we'll listen to a few clips of that. You might want to go and listen to it on your own, and then we'll wrap things up.
What happened was that the huge corporations like Disney and Comcast, AT&T, Viacom, huge conglomerates, they saw the amount of money that Fox made with a presentation that was very inexpensive to produce. So they saw that Fox galvanized a certain amount of people in America, millions and millions of people. Now, you can assign different reasons why, but the bottom line was that billions with a B of dollars flowed in to the Fox News channel. And that, of course, lifted the parent company so they could do a lot of other things. Once that was established, and that was established right after 9/11 as a real firm, this is the way the industry's going. Then they all started to copy. And then it reached a crescendo of absurdity under Donald Trump, where you didn't have any fact finding at all. All you had was, we hate them. So if you hate them, you watch us, or we love them. And if you love them, you watch us. So that destroyed journalism in America, because the major corporations basically put the word out that you're going to do it this way. You're not going to look for the facts and what's really true or any of the subtleties. You're going to hate them or you're going to love them. And so that's why we're in the mess we're in right now. I worked at the networks for Dan Rather and Peter Jennings. I know what it used to be and I know what it is now. And it's not even in the same hemisphere. Because now the big corporations, and I include the New York Times and Washington Post in this, and the Associated Press, they basically let the correspondents and the producers, the news gatherers, know what they want to hear, mm-hmm. not what they might find out. But this is what we want to hear, because, as you said, they're supersizing their point of view to bring in a specific audience. If you go against that, you're not going to do well. When you're in a person who does not know very much, who doesn't follow the news, then you're hearing all of this stuff. What are you going to believe? So we have a country that's being misled by both sides. And that's so dangerous, I can't even describe it.
So this hereby concludes this season of the Media Roundtable. I just want to tell you guys, thank you so much for your support, for listening, for getting behind this. I hope you've been entertained and I hope you've been informed and I hope that it's helpful. You know, we're not doing this because we're just trying to build a media business ourselves. We traffic in media. We transact in media. We're brokers of media. The reason we're doing this is because we don't want to be involved in an industry that poisons its customers and that does harm when people are trusting it to help them. We've got big problems in this country. And some of that is political. And you see it in things like insurrection at the Capitol. But it's also, how do you get along with the people that you know and you care about, people that you grew up with, your family, your friends? How do we maintain relationships? How do we maintain sanity? How do we have a quality of life? How do we get anything done if we're all fighting about stupid crap all the time? There's a lot of things that are worth fighting for, but I think we need to fight fair. We need to fight clean. And we need to remember that you can go hard on an issue, but we don't have to go so hard on the people. And so whatever you're doing, whatever sphere of influence you have, maybe you have two friends, maybe you run a big media company, I don't know. Whatever you do, think about how you can participate in this movement from where you live, from where you stand. Who are you going to talk to tomorrow? What decisions are you going to make? Can you steward your dollars toward content that is constructive, toward a better conversation, toward a more edifying type of conversation? Can you steward your attention in that way? Can you listen to somebody who you completely disagree with and try to understand why they think the way that they do. And can you be loving to people who may not be loving to you first? Because we can't figure that out. I don't know how we're going to get out of any of this. But one thing I will promise you is that we will continue the good fight on our side. We will come back next season. We want to hear from you. If you haven't already, like we've talked about so many times before, make sure you visit oxfordroad.com and subscribe to our newsletter, which is called The Influencer. Go to mediaroundtable.com and communicate to us. Tell us what you love. Tell us what you hate. We want to hear it. We can take feedback. And if you are interested in doing this as a business, if you want to be part of our mission of mobilizing marketers to promote truth and civility in journalism, think about our values. Go and check them out. Clarity, truth, fairness, respect, de-escalation, and tolerance. We want you to engage with these things at mediaroundtable.com. And I want to give a special thanks. This has been a long season. It's hard to make these shows. It can be very thankless at times. And we've had a great team who's been helping us. I want to give special thanks to Bianca, to Kyle, to Jennifer, to the team at Podcast One, and to all of you for supporting us. Keep coming back. We'll be here. And we're just so grateful to have you with us. Enjoy your summer.